Okay. Yep.
Is it okay if the trend that you found is it is really,
Yeah.
really
Yeah.
warm?
Yeah, especially for me, surrounded with this too. I'm fine. I'm fine. I can adjust. Little bit, just. And thank you. So again, welcome to you all, and thanks so much for coming. It's my honor, my fortune to be here. First time in Ireland, first time meeting most of you. So newcomer in every sense. One of my teachers will teach me. It's like we are students forever, right? So there's no problem with remaining a newcomer for eternity. We are always learning something new. So yeah, I'm very excited to get to meet you and share with you today, tomorrow. About some whatever may be necessary to share, to inspire ourselves in Krishna consciousness in our spiritual journey today, tomorrow, no? Day after tomorrow, that's another thing. That maybe we may need something different, no? So what's the necessity for this precise moment, right? And of course, each one of us is in a different stage of the journey. We're unique individuals. So of course I will be speaking in general. I'm not gonna know in detail each one of you, so I'm not addressing any specific case, but I trust that whatever I may speak, you will have the discernment to see how much that speaks to your journey or not. That's it. Okay. Irish wind, right? Yeah, I'm having a taste these days. It's fine. I like it. I like it. So the idea that came was to share a few thoughts about a recent book that I published. It's my third book. It's called Evolution in Divine Love, The Eternal Becoming of God, Soul, and Matter. So it's a book that where my main intention in writing a book, because to be honest, I don't like, I mean, to write a book is not easy. Some people may idealize an author, like, okay, you sit on the table and just like, there is the next book, and there comes the next one. No, it's tapasya in many ways, a beautiful one. So, but I personally, I don't like to write books that I don't feel are not speaking to something that is necessary to speak of. If not, I don't have the inspiration to write the book. And in the case of this last book, I felt the need, starting with myself, of conceiving the spiritual life as something dynamic, conceiving our practice, our goal, our everything as something that is in constant growth and evolution. Because many times, whether we know it or not, sometimes we move through life with more, how to say, rigid patterns or not so dynamic patterns. I'm thinking about, well, this is Krishna, this is who I am, this is what bhakti is, this is what this world is. And we may learn, as we all did probably in our early days, the certain formulas to define each thing, which I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just saying at some point we need to explore what's in between the lines and the letters of those formulas, right? Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I'm not coming here to contradict that. But what it means, what it means that Krishna is the Supreme, is each word is very carefully, I will say, very carefully selected by Prabhupada, Supreme Personality of Godhead. Just to give an example, there's so much in between. God has a person, God is a person that to begin has personality. There is a supreme aspect of his personality. So what's that? What's that mean? So I like, yeah, when I write the book, for me it's more like more an exploration than an explanation. I try to explain things, but also I try to keep the exploration open, because we are trying to say something about the infinite. So how can we say exploration project over? No, I'm exploring the infinite. It's always new, it's always fresh. So that's the spirit of the book, trying to give us a taste of newness and freshness, and every day that we are waking up again, feeling okay, there's a whole horizon, exciting horizon of surprise and wonder and things that hopefully justify my day, so to say. And not just going through the days through the motions like in autopilot. So it's okay, I have to do this. If it starts with I have to, try to reframe the sentence. No? I have to. How can I reframe to say I want to? No? I long to. I desire to. I hope to, whatever. So the book is divided in four parts. No? It starts speaking about love, bhakti. Then it goes to God, Krishna, then it goes to us, the soul, and then it goes to the material energy, which are kind of the main departments that we usually speak about. The energetic source, Shaktiman, God, and the three energies, Swarup Shakti, Tatastha Shakti, Maya Shakti, love, soul, and matter. So in my book, I try to explore how we can think of each of them as always in movement, always in growth, in their own unique manner. How love is constantly expanding. How Krishna is constantly becoming more Krishna. That sounds interesting. Can Krishna become more Krishna? Well, scripture said he can. Why to impose such a limitation? Right? Chaitanya Charitamrita says at every moment, Krishna becomes more beautiful, more attractive. And Krishna means the all attractive. So if the all attractive becomes more attractive, and Krishna means the all attractive, means Krishna becomes more Krishna. Krishna is Krishnaizing himself every moment and finding himself more beautiful, not in a narcissistic way. We have these very beautiful descriptions in the scriptures where Krishna is looking at the pillar, jewel pillar, and he becomes like kidnapped by his own reflection, so to say, like charmed by the beauty of his own reflection. It's too much beauty to bear. So how to keep pace with a reality that is always growing? So one of the intentions for me to write about that also was to give a sense of relief to the devotees, starting with me. I also need my relief. I also carry sometimes my religious PTSD. Sometimes we carry our anarthas, pre-Krishna consciousness, but sometimes we heal or purify some of those anarthas. But without knowing, we sometimes acquire new ones after joining. Not because Krishna consciousness gives an artist, but sometimes a misunderstanding, a misreading, a partial understanding can become a problem. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur calls that bhakti-yuta anartha. Anarthas that happen after you became a devotee. Right? And I know cases. Again, with this, we are not blaming anyone. It's just analyzing a situation. I know devotees who had, I don't know, very healthy, relatively healthy childhood with their parents, good experience with their primary caretakers, their main authority figures, mom and dad. So somehow they had a healthy idea of God then, because I had a healthy idea of my parents' authority figure. Now it goes to the ultimate authority figure, and somehow, if we don't have a good experience with them, we tend to project that with the ultimate dad. So sometimes you see that they had a good experience with their parents, healthy relationship with God, and then they happen to join bhakti at a certain particular place where, let's say, the temple president had a more traumatized experience with their parents. So this is that he started like beating. No, Krishna is not easily pleased, and if you fail on this, he will be very angry with you. You may lose your human form of life very easily, basically, if you are not perfect. And that creates religious trauma, basically. Maybe you came with a nice idea and then you received a distorted picture of who Krishna is. On one side, hearing Krishna Karuna Sindhu, oh, ocean of mercy. And on another side, I've seen the Buddha telling me, I don't know, Maharaj, I'm having a pregnancy, or even in some cases, I've recently lost a pregnancy, very delicate situation. I'm somehow not able to finish my 16 rounds, and I'm so terrified that Krishna will take away my human form of life. So, and I'm like, that's not Krishna. How can you think that Krishna is such a bad guy? Not to promote laziness, just to have a coherent picture of what it means to be an ocean of mercy, an ocean of compassion, an ocean of forgiveness. And on that foundation, we can gain enthusiasm and inspiration, right? So one of the main aspects of my book, also I'm trying, starting with myself again, to practice my spiritual life in a way that is sustainable, because I want to practice this for eternity, right? I don't want just to be a, how to say this in English? Does any of you speak Spanish? Sorry. This like sudden stars that come and disappear. Shooting stars. Thank you. You always learn something new. So I don't want to be a bhakti shooting star. No. That appears, shines, and disappears. No. So you have Bhakta Joseph, like, wow, he's so shiny, he's so perfect, everything. Bhakta, where's Bhakta Joseph? Shooting star. At least I don't want that for me. I want to practice this for eternity. So how can I make my bhakti, my spiritual life, sustainable? In short term, middle term, long term, eternal term. How my bhakti project, as I like to call it, how my bhakti project can be sustainable for eternity. We have to think about it. We don't want again to be an ecstatic shooting star honeymoon period and then dissolve into the Milky Way or whatever. Or burn out in the worst possible way. It happens, let's be honest. So we don't want that. So how to practice in a sustainable way? As we were talking a few days ago in, I don't remember anymore where, I've been traveling a lot, maybe Germany, maybe Switzerland, some of those places, about how our tradition is, one of the names is Vaishnavism. The word Vaishnavism is connected to Vishnu. Vaishnava, Vishnu, and Vishnu, we have this triad of Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, right? Brahma creating, Shiva destroying, Vishnu. We were talking with you these days also, right? Okay, maybe that was the talk. In Ireland, we talk about that. So Vishnu is the maintainer. Vishnu is the god of maintenance. So if you want, Vishnu is the god of sustainability. So as Vaishnavas, as devotees of such a god, we have to be examples of sustainability. That has to be a very important concern for us. How do I make my life, my practice, my relationships with Krishna, with everyone, sustainable? Not again, honeymoon, ecstatic, kijai, and then dissolution. Then calling Lord Shiva for final, please destroy all this, right? How to sustain it? How to maintain it? And of course, you can only maintain something by making it grow. Not like a relationship. If you have a relationship with your wife, with your husband, you can never maintain the relationship for 3 decades, always on the same point. That's not maintenance. That's the beginning of the end. You can only maintain by growing. So Krishna consciousness is basically a relationship. It's our relationship project with God. And by extension with everyone else, just to make it clear, loving Krishna does not exclude loving everyone else. It's not that Krishna loves you and I'm absolutely dysfunctional about how to relate with the rest of creation. That's not loving Krishna. Like Kapila Deb says famously in the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, if you worship me in the deity form, but then mistreat my devotees or other fellow humans, that worship is like throwing ashes onto the fire, which basically means useless. Use another strong words. Like saying, if you approach me, relate to me, love me, worship me, but that love is not reflected in how you treat me in everyone's heart, you are missing the point, Krishna said. Yes, I'm in the altar, Krishna said, but I'm also in the altar of everyone's heart. Every person is a walking temple in that sense. If every heart is an altar, every living being is a walking temple. So going to a temple should be for us a reminder of then how to treat the walking temples that we find throughout our day, and how to honor God's presence in those places. So these are some themes I'm talking about in my book. And for me, all this is to trying to create a practice of bhakti that at least, sorry if it sounds selfish, but that works for me. And by this, I'm not saying let's change the whole philosophy so it works for me. But let's find a way of becoming a devotee that works for me without having to, of course, distort the tradition. And it's possible. And it won't be the same way for everyone. Each devotee, each person will find their way that being a devotee works better. We are not, none of us is equal to each other. So thank God. Two Swami Padmanabhas? No, thank you. I have enough with one of those myself. So each devotee will have to discover their way of practicing bhakti in a healthy, sustainable way. And there is a section of the book that I wanted to address. I don't have books here with me. They are somewhere in the box, but it's okay. It's okay. I will just speak about it. I won't bore you just reading. I just share some thoughts. And that section of the book is called Spiritual Imperfectionism. It's a little bit on purpose that I use the title. Spiritual Imperfectionism, like indicating sometimes we have this syndrome of spiritual perfectionism. We become obsessed with perfection, but to a point that it becomes toxic, right? To a point that we are never enough. We can never reach the perfect state to be a perfect whatever. Perfect guru, perfect sannyasi, perfect devotee, perfect wife, perfect husband, perfect son. We have this idea of perfection that sometimes becomes limiting, actually, interestingly. Any talk of perfection should ideally liberate us. Inspire us, free us. Many times, perfection talk, perfection kata, sometimes becomes threatening, intimidating, discouraging, even weaponizing. We can invoke these ideas of perfection to make everyone feel you are not there. Sorry. No, you are not there yet. This is perfection. You are not there. This is perfection. Or sometimes we do that to ourselves. No. Sometimes we don't need anyone to tell that to us. We are our worst judges many times. Even if someone does that to us, we generally have the bigger whip, the biggest whip for reserved for us. No, I'm not enough, I'm not good enough. And sometimes that goes way worse than that. I'm worthless. There's something intrinsically bad with myself. And this weekend we were doing a workshop with some of you may know Mahatma Prabhu. And Dhanya and Sukabaha, anyhow, a few Prabhupada disciples and other devotees talking on some things like that. One of those being toxic shame. No? This idea that sometimes we become convinced we are bad. Not so much I did something bad, but I am bad. There is something wrong with me in my very core. That's, I will say, the worst anartha. The worst capital sin. Sometimes we may talk about lust, envy, greed, anger. And we need to talk about all that. But sometimes we forget to talk about things like shame and toxic shame in particular. Because, of course, if you do something terribly wrong, okay, there's place to feeling ashamed, to feel guilt. If not, you become a psychopath. But if you feel toxic shame, it's like an over exacerbated sense of feeling bad about yourself to a point that is it's not healthy. And sometimes this is connected with this contrast with perfection. And we can always bring the perfection card, but almost always the perfection card, as a friend of mine will say, spoils the deck, so to say. It doesn't create healing. And why I mention this, I have nothing against the word perfection, just to be clear. I'm not here to say let's be as imperfect as we can. Well, sometimes with this obsession with perfection, we end up hating ourselves many times, or rejecting ourselves because I'm never perfect enough. And we do not end up accepting ourselves. So we can change that. I mean, I'm not, we have to change lots of stuff for sure, at least myself. But I can only change one for if I first accept myself where I am. If I'm in deep denial and deep self-rejection of where I am, I can never change because change has to happen on the realistic foundation of where You follow my idea? That's what Krishna says in the Gita to Arjuna, right? You better perform your duty imperfectly than someone else's duty perfectly. Krishna is not promoting imperfection there, right? He's not saying try to do your stuff as worse as you can, as bad as you can. He's just trying to say, accept who you are, where you are, and don't try to live someone else's life. Don't imitate others. Don't compare yourself to others. That's such a formula for misery. And of course, I'm not saying that to make you feel more miserable, because probably we all do that. So I'm speaking all the things just to normalize that this is part of the journey, right? I'm not saying that to say, you are doing any of this, you should feel so ashamed about yourself. You are so bad. I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's part of the journey. And until and unless we acknowledge that, we will never be able to transcend it, right? So, and the point I'm trying to make in my book on perfection and imperfection is that, and it's an important point, at least for me. Okay, we will say if I ask any of you, probably I will ask you, okay, what's the goal of our life, the goals of practicing bhakti, Krishna consciousness? Probably some will say the goal is to develop, I don't know, prem bhakti, divine love for Radha and Krishna, pure devotion, different words we may use. And that's totally fine. But let me add a footnote to that, which is no matter how advanced you become, how pure you become, how loving you become, you can always become more pure, more advanced, more. There is no rooftop to perfection. Because for many of us, perfection sounds like a fixed maximum. I reach perfection, game over. I'm perfect, nothing else. And if you start to think about that for a moment, at least for me, that sounds so boring. Right? I reach perfection, nothing else to attain, discover, learn, experience because I'm perfect now. That's boring. Even when we say Krishna is perfect, let's not limit Krishna to this is only the only way you can be perfect. That's so imperfect. The scripture we find Krishna experiencing wonder and surprise at every moment. So if he's perfect and knows everything, how he will experience that? There is a space for further perfection. I mean, Krishna is perfect, but he becomes more perfect, more perfect, more perfect. So why I'm saying all this? Because once we understand perfection is an ongoing state of eternal development, when we stop being obsessed with, I have to attain perfection. Because what's perfection if it's always expanding? So what's the idea for me with this is, wherever I am on my journey, I can ask, okay, what's the perfection that I'm invited to embrace today? Tomorrow, I can ask the same question. And maybe today, the best thing close to perfection is to be perfectly honest about my imperfections. That may be as close as I can get to perfection today. I'll be perfectly honest and sincere about how imperfect I am. I try to be as perfect as I can in that. That's what Krishna praises in the Bhagavad Gita, one of the most controversial verses of the Bhagavad Gita. No wonder why. 9:30, when he says, Apichetsudra cherubajanti mama nanyabak sadurima samamta vyasamyakya vyasito. He's saying, even if you behave very imperfectly, but you are very sincerely dedicated to me, in my opinion, Krishna says, you are a sadhu. That can be shocking. But he starts saying, even if you are very imperfect, still. But if you are very sincerely determined, in my eyes, you're already there. Even if it's a matter of time and you find, okay, in order to reach to this goal, I'm here on the path. But if you're honestly threading the path, Krishna already thinks, you're already there. I already see you as someone who is sadhu. That's Krishna's generosity. That's how we are being seen by the divine. He's not judging us for what we did in the past, for what we are doing even in the present. He's seeing us for all that we can be in potential in the future. That's a very loving sight. That's how a guru, a true saintly person, should look at us. Not only, you did this 20 years ago, I know you, and I put you in certain box. So, Eshi Mardana, you did this 15 years ago. One day you were chanting japa and your mind went. It's an hypothetical example, not personal accusation. Sorry, I use the audience as an example sometimes. You were chanting and your mind got distracted for 5 minutes. I still remember that, Krishna will say, 20 years ago. I will not easily forget that. That's not Krishna again. Or even, you're still doing that at the present moment. Krishna is seeing us what we want to become in the future. What's our honest aspiration? And he's seeing us according to that. So that's a very hopeful, generous vision. So this notion of spiritual imperfectionism, again, it's not a promotion of being imperfect, but it's more like an invitation to honestly be perfectly honest, accepting our imperfection, and knowing an important point in connection to all that, knowing that despite our imperfection, despite our conditioning, Krishna already loves us. These are good news. I hope so. Krishna loves you as imperfect as you still are. Maybe for some of us, that's shocking news. Well, he already loves me, but I'm so imperfect. I thought he will love me only when I will become pure, perfect. No, he already loves you. It's not that you have first to become this and only then Krishna's affection goes to you. That will be very conditional, right? The condition being, only when you become a pure devotee, okay, send me a message, I'll love you back. Only when you love me first, Krishna will tell us, I'll love you back. Doesn't make sense. We couldn't love Krishna first if he wouldn't love us first. The fact that we are trying to love Krishna is only because Krishna loves us to begin with. The famous Christian mystic Thomas Merton will say, when we are praying, we are not kick-starting the conversation. We are praying, trying to return God's embrace to us. So when I'm sitting on my daily meditation, prayer room, japa moment, whatever, it's not that I'm doing a favor to Krishna. Okay, I'm starting this conversation. I'm calling Krishna, because if I do not start, he will not pay attention to me. I don't know. The fact that you can think that you are starting something is because he has already started the thing. So we are trying just to return the embrace. We do not practice bhakti so Krishna loves us. We practice bhakti so we can love Krishna back. It's not just a few words rearranged in a sentence. That's a huge change of perspective. The goal of life is not love from Krishna. The goal of life is love for Krishna. Love from Krishna is already given from time without beginning. Because he is love. He is love from tip to toe. That's his essence. So he's loving in every direction. So bhakti, Krishna consciousness, is not a practice to earn, to deserve Krishna's love. Krishna's love is too much to be deserved. We have to use another currency. The word deserving disappears at that point. Ahai tu kiya pratihata jayatma suprasiddhati, says the Bhagavatam. Savaipum samparo dhanmo jato bhakti. No? Full satisfaction for the soul comes when you can return bhakti to Krishna in a spontaneous, natural way. And that's the nature of bhakti. Ahai tu kiya. Ahai tu kiya means without cause. In other words, Krishna is loving you. And you may ask for a cause. Why he's loving? What did I do for him to love me? No, it doesn't work like that. God's unconditional love is not about what I did to earn him loving me. Probably we did pretty much in the opposite direction, not to deserve, and still that's coming. That's an important point in connection to this notion of imperfection, because somehow I can, again, I'm not saying this for you to remain, to become complacent and say, oh, so Krishna loves me, I'm imperfect. I can just relax for forever. That's it. He loves me. Yeah, but you have to love him back. That's the goal. And that may take work. But to know that we already been loved, that in itself for me at least is a very powerful foundation. So I'm not practicing. I'm not chanting. I'm not serving. So Krishna likes me. That's already happening. So I'm just trying to love him back. And everyone. Love everyone back. Because loving Krishna means loving everyone. Let's not forget that. No. Krishna and everything else do not exist in isolation from each other. God is not like an entity in a bubble and the rest of creation is in another bubble. Everything is interconnected with Krishna. Krishna is the center, Mukhya Sambandha. Chaitanya Charitamrita says. Mukhya Sambandha means he in relationship to whom everything has its primary relationship. Mukhya means primary. Sambandha means relationship. So Krishna is he who in relationship to whom everyone and everything has its primary connection. He's the center. And we're all constellating around with him. Hopefully not as shooting stars. Right? So... So I think for me this is important. I won't go into any specified cases with names and things like that. That wouldn't be ethical. But I cannot tell you enough how many cases I hear from devotees sharing. And this is beyond our tradition. This happens in every spiritual tradition, just in case. No. It's not that there's something wrong with us and everyone else is doing it perfectly. This human condition. But I cannot tell you how many times I'm hearing from practitioners, yeah, this sense of guilt or shame or fear of intimidation or pressure to be perfect. And many times that ends up being a performance. No? I'm not perfect. Okay, well, I pretend that I'm perfect. And this goes beyond spiritual circles. It's in societies everywhere. No? Okay, my face doesn't look perfect, but I'll go through the Instagram filters and make my face perfect. So whatever the case, no, we have this pattern in our current times. We are not, how to say, imperfection is not, let's put it mildly, it's not the very much appreciated, to say the least. If I show myself imperfect, vulnerable, honest, sincere, many people may get terrified about it. Put your masks. You are scary. How you dare to appear without masks? That's terrifying. Whoosh. I don't know what to do. You show up for who you are. I need you to put your mask. So we keep this mask festival ongoing. That's conditions existence. It's a mask festival. Basically, everyone puts their own mask, and not only one, sometimes layers of them. Upadhis, we call them sometimes, like different designations. We wear them to gain acceptance, to deserve, to feel. In behind all that, I'm not condemning those who do that. Behind all that is a needy soul who is thirsty for belonging, right? To feel part, to feel accepted, again, to feel loved. But sometimes we mistake all these ideas and. And for example, the term that I like to use, we all need to belong, to feel that we belong. But sometimes we confuse belonging with fitting in. Even many times we use the two words as if they were the same. I'm not fitting in. You don't need to fit in. You need to belong. Because belonging means I show up for who I am, and that allows me the experience of belonging. Fitting in, the condition for fitting in is you have to put a mask on. You cannot be who you are. You have to be something you are not, then you fit it. But fitting in is not enough. We need to belong. That's why no matter how hard we try to fit in, no matter how many masks we try, many at the same time, there is something that still says, something still. I don't belong. Again, I fit in. I've acquired a PhD in fitting in, but still I don't know how to belong because belonging implies take down all the masks. And that can be scary, of course. That can be terrifying. But that's invitation again of the Gita, as I say before, Krishna saying, do your dharma imperfectly basically means be who you are as you are. That's way better. Be honest about your imperfection, way better than a fake perfection, a show performance. Krishna say, I don't want that. That's not you. I want you as you are, even if it's fragile, broken, messy, traumatized, all the layers of human complexity, still not fully integrated. But at least be honest in that. Be perfectly honest in your imperfection. And that's the ideal first step. And then everything comes from that. All the transformation, all the change, all the realizations, all the attainments. But again, it's an ongoing journey. So in one sense, there is no final attainment. There's always a new attainment and a new attainment. Even if you're in Golok Vrindavan, there is a new level of love to discover next day and next day. So that keeps the journey moving. At least for me, that's way more enticing and exciting than to say love has an end point, like a dead row. Dead row, you say? No, when you're walking on a dead end, dead ends. Love has a dead end. Okay, welcome to Golok Vrindavan, a dead end. No, I stay here then. So no, it's not. That's not Golok Vrindavan. Spiritual world is not a dead end. It's a festival of emotions. That's the word used in Sanskrit, bhavotsav. That place is called a festival of emotions, constantly newer and newer experiences. So rather than become obsessed with perfection or become obsessed with a goal that once I attain it, it's done, game over, dead end. Why not, in my opinion, again, all this is how I feel it's sustainable for me and for others, I will dare to say, to practice bhakti. Instead of becoming goal-oriented, perfection-oriented, or perfection obsessed, becoming presence oriented. No? What will happen tomorrow, the end of this life, next life? It all depends how I'm living today, September 15, 2025. Tomorrow is another day. Because if we become too focused on what will happen at the end of this life, in the next decade, in three lifetimes, you may be bypassing, doing spiritual bypassing to the here and now. So whatever we want to attain or whatever we want to experience here or at some point, we have to choose it in the present moment. If I want to love Krishna in a certain way, I have to be doing something here and now for that to happen. It's not that magically happens against my wish or against my will, right? Krishna's not that cruel, right? If you haven't invest, you express your will in certain direction with him, he won't send you to a particular place in a particular relationship that you've never chosen. No? Love is voluntary. Krishna wants us to participate in a relationship. It's back and forth. It's reciprocal. Like when Rupa Goswami beautifully describes the six loving exchanges between devotees. Actually, he describes three loving exchanges in reciprocal directions, right? Giving, receiving. Prasad, gifts, your mind, your heart. That is giving, receiving. So it's always reciprocal. Love implies a back and forth. It's not just unidirectional. It's not Krishna doing all the stuff and me just being a passive consumer of grace. Nor is me doing all the stuff and Krishna just waiting for me to be perfect and then he will put an eye on me. No, it's a teamwork. It's a relationship. So, these are some thoughts in connection to some of the topics of this recent book that we have chosen to speak about, Evolution and Divine Love. So hopefully we can gain some experience and idea of bhakti as ever evolving, ever expanding. As Mahaprabhu will say at the first verse of Shikshastakam, right? Anandam buddhi vardhanam pratipadam purnamritashvadanam. Bhakti means ananda ambuddhi vardhanam. You are deeply immersing yourself in an ocean of ecstasy, and which the nature of that pratipadam purnamritashvadanam. At every step, you will be tasting a new layer of the nectar of immortality. At every step, something new. So I personally think that's the best motivator for us to practice and to be alive, even meaning and purpose. Okay, there is something waiting there for me that I can discover. As a devotee recently told me, purpose is the best alarm clock, huh? The best reason to wake up every morning, basically. There's purpose, meaning, something waiting for me there. So we can really practice bhakti for the right reasons. No? So we choose voluntarily to surrender for the right reasons, out of excitement, out of wonder, out of gratitude, out of positive content. No? Hopefully not out of fear, intimidation, social pressure, I have to, toxic shame, fitting in, you pick the word, whatever. So that's what, in my opinion, will make the bhakti journey sustainable. Not only sustainable, like a sustainable torture, but something joyful. Well, Krishna says in Gita, right? Susukam kartum. This dharma, this bhakti, nine chapter, he says, has to be executed susukam, huh? Very joyfully. Even when we are going through harsh times, I mean, we are not denying difficult chapters, but even when we are going through some tough chapters of the journey, still we can see so much goodness and beauty and grace coming. So many reasons to continue the journey. So that what keeps the journey sustainable, short, middle, long term, eternal term. And we can see ourselves doing bhakti forever. Because if the way I'm doing practicing Krishna consciousness now is kind of a torture, and then now comes Swami Padmanabhan is telling you, and we want to do bhakti for eternity. I said, oh, but it's a torture so far. And you want to send me there for eternity? That sounds like hell, not heaven. So we have to be practicing bhakti in a way that it's hopeful to be doing that for eternity. That when someone comes and says, and you will be doing that for eternity. And you are like, oh, great, ki jai. If you are not saying ki jai after receiving those news, it's not a problem with bhakti, but it's like how I'm practicing. Because we are not doing bhakti, so as a result of that, we receive something else or something different. Like someone asks, as I always say, someone asked once Srila Prabhupada, what's the result of chanting Hare Krishna? And he was kind of surprised by the question. Like it came like a little bit in a transactional spirit. So I'm doing this. What's the result? And he said, like the result of chanting Hare Krishna is that you will be able to chant more Hare Krishna. Like we are not doing this to stop doing this at some point and start doing something else. So the real question is how I'm doing this in a way that is happy to for me to think, oh, I'll be doing this forever. So we need to practice our spiritual life today in certain ways that we have these insights in our heart that it comes and we can feel really, oh, I could be doing this forever. So we have, I don't know, to relate to one another in ways that are so hopefully honest, sincere, open, loving that we feel, oh, I feel so happy sharing my heart with this brother and sister. I could be doing this forever. Oh, this kirtan is so deep, so moving, so touching, so open, so sincere. I could be doing this forever, and so on and so forth. When you feel like that, you are having a glimpse of eternity. Basically, you are inhabiting eternity at that moment. That's why we say in our tradition we don't care for liberation, because we are already doing what we want to be doing forever. So liberation. It's an issue from the past. I'm already doing what I want to do forever. But again, we have to be practicing in a way that we can actually say that. Right? So that's an invitation. That's a private homework that I give to each of us, including myself. Like, wait, am I practicing? Am I living my life in a way that I'm okay with this lifestyle in eternity? Or the idea of living my life like this for eternity feels problematic, to say the least. If so, what I may need to adjust today, here and now, because again, the change is here and now. Not some magical thinking that something will happen miraculously without me choosing that also. So how we can continue to adjust, aligned, so we can live our lives with purpose, with meaning, choosing it. He's giving blessings. Yes. That's how it works. Thank you. I needed some reassurance. Yes, Maharaj, you're not so crazy. Yeah, it's okay. It makes sense to me. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And we have lots to learn from babies, no, right? Because a baby is like no mask, right? That's why we feel so uncomfortable sometimes. The baby starts to shout and scream, and like, stop, stop, stop. No, because many times the baby, or crying, no, stop crying. Why? Because the baby is reminding us all our ungrieved tears, and the baby is crying without filter. And we may be swallowing and repressing so much time, the baby is mirroring back all the things that we are. So much to learn in every direction. That's why one of the 24 gurus of the Bhagavatam in the 11 cantos is a baby. That's a very interesting section. 24 gurus, 23 are non-human. Just to make the case, to make the point, there's lots of gurus out there. You have lots to learn from. It starts with Mother Earth, the wind and the bumblebee and the deer and the spider. Humans are not appearing in the parampara. And when the human comes, one baby, one little girl, and to crown the list, a prostitute. Like to give the example of the person you thought the least you could learn something from is also included. So, thanks for bringing the baby today. We have one very honorable member of the parampara from the Bharat with us today. So I hope we are all learning our lessons. Yeah.
I'm sorry for the instruction to scolding, but
No. I'm not sending any subliminal message complaining about anything. That's great.
During the third time, it was so charming to see the little baby walk
Yeah.
around. Just magic.
Yes. Hopefully, all whenever she screams or something, it's also charming. Yeah. Hey, we can learn so much from a baby. I don't want to sound like I'm taking her as an example only now, but I remember, for example, one author that I like to read, and he will say, like, babies, very charming. Right? I mean, now we saw her, we kind of are accustomed to her presence now, but if there will be no baby here, and suddenly you enter with your baby, my class is over. I lost all of the audience. Everyone will be like, shoom. Including myself, probably. We'll be like,
Baby mask.
Yeah. When things get a little rough, like you put the baby mask on. Are we, because we're naturally drawn to a baby, and one reason we could say why is because also a baby is so vulnerable. So such a fragile creature. So it's attractive to be in a vulnerable situation, not hiding it. Because the baby is vulnerable and it's not hiding it. Not has not learned yet putting masks, so to say, as we do human adults, quote unquote. So that's unconsciously, we don't know maybe, but it's like, why I'm so attracted to that small creature, beautiful. Maybe because it's fully vulnerable and it's not hiding it. So the more we learn to do that, or the more we unlearn and relearn to do that, the more attractive and charming we can also become to one another. And our relationships can become attractive in the good sense of the term. So, anyhow, some rambling, share with all of you some thoughts. And I like also to keep it open if you have questions or something you may like to share, to ask about. Maybe mostly connected to what we've been sharing so far, but if there's anything else that needs to be brought to the table, also feel free to share. There are no silly questions, as long as they are honest and necessary for each of you. Or even it can be, again, not a question, it can be a comment, whatever.
As
Yes.
you were saying earlier, but it's very personal. One Christian man, I think it's Vincent Peale,
Okay.
he said, God can make a path for each of us where there is no path. But that's so fascinating.
Yeah.
So in the scriptures or the books, there may not be mentioned what your condition is, but because God is God, he knows exactly. He can make a path for each of us.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. He's very creative, very graceful, and very creative in how to create that, yeah, that thing that for us may be impossible. Sometimes we convince ourselves, I'm a hopeless case, right? There's no path for me. There's no light at the end of the tunnel. But that's, as you say, God sees. No? What we don't see, he sees, or this, or those enlightened people see. And that's why we hear so many times this analogy of learning to see. Om Gyan Atimirandasya, Guru, opening our eyes with torch of knowledge, like teaching us how to see what we are missing. Like we may be missing, oh, there's a path for me, there's hope, I'm locked. Oh, we need someone to show not just you need just to recalibrate and look in that direction. The light was over there. Oh, I was too much obsessed in my cave. No, it was over that direction. Oh, it's there.
Like you said, it's an ongoing process. It's not static. And even Krishna says that himself. In what it 10:10, he says, to those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give the understanding by which they come to me. So if you're already constantly devoted to serving Krishna with love, why would you need understanding to come to him? Because it deepens, it
You can
goes
always
deeper.
come to him deeper.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate the reading of that verse because sometimes we may know these verses, famous ones, and quote them, but there's so many ways of rediscovering
Yeah.
these verses from new perspectives. So thank you for gifting me with that reading. I know that verse by heart for decades, but I've never read that verse in that way. So thank you so much. Yeah. Yes.
Point you're making that Krishna loves everyone regardless of the heart condition. I just want, I personally, I've never came across a verse, I can't think of them anyway, either in Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam, where Krishna looks at that direction that he does love all living entities. You know, if you have statements like, I am the heart of all living entities, I am the father of all living entities, I am the beginning and the end of all things, statements like this, but I can't think of a statement where Krishna says that he loves all living
Last
entities.
verse of chapter 5. Bhoktaram yajñatapasam
He says the friend, yeah, he says,
Suhridam sarvabhutanam.
yeah, he
I'm the
said.
well-wishing friend of every living entity. I mean, I cannot be your best well-wishing friend if and not love you.
Okay, but it's not exactly, he's not exactly expressing, I love you, you know, I love you. I can't, and also in the names of, in the, you know, 1,000 names of Vishnu and stuff, you have all of these names that give the attributes of Krishna, but again, I can't think of one where he's, he, where he, where his name is the one who loves all living entities. I'm not doubting that, but I'm just
No.
curious
I
why it's
really
like
I
that.
appreciate your. It's funny because you're mentioning this point and the, specifically referring to the 1,000 names of Vishnu. And yesterday I gave a lecture on this conference we had with Mahatma Prabhu and other devotees about, and my topic was self-love in bhakti. How can I love myself knowing that Krishna loves me? And one part of my presentation was to go to some of the names of the Vishnu Sahasranam, the 1,000 names of Vishnu, as a proof that Krishna loves us. I don't want to, I don't want to mean that I'm trying to contradict you. And I have some of these names here. For me, they mean, they are clearly meaning he loves me. We can have a difference of opinion here. That's totally fine. Again, I want that to make clear also. No, I'm coming to speak. Doesn't mean that whatever the Swami says, you are forced to agree with. Okay? Feel free to disagree with Swami Padmanabha at every point of your journey. We can always have an exciting conversation about what we disagree about. But let me share a few names since you brought them. Of course, maybe none of the names say, my name means I love you, but it makes sense for me that that's the case. And for example, Bhuta Brit. He who takes care of all beings in the universe. Bhuta Bhavana, he who nurtures every being. Anukul, he who is positively interested in everyone. Suhrit, he who has the greatest heart. Batsi, he who is affectionate. Not affectionate in every direction. Basumanas, he whose mind dwells in all beings. Dripta, he whoever has ever drunk by the bliss of love. Lokabandhu, he who is the eternal friend of all. Nivritatma, he who is always available everywhere. Parjanya, he who is like a rain cloud, basically showering mercy equally to all without discrimination. Sarva tomo ka, he who can be approached from any direction. Anyhow, Sulava, he who is easily attained. Ashram, he who is shelter for those battered by life's storms. And many more, no? Arodra, he who is never angry. The last one here is Pranabrit, he who nurtures all beings. Again, for me, putting all that in context says Krishna loves me.
Yeah, I know.
And for me, the main point besides this list, and again, I'm not trying here like to convince you or anything, but for me, the fact that Krishna is love, no? For example, Raso Vai Saha, Taittiriya Upanishad says, Rupa Goswami bases his whole Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu on that line. Raso Vai Saha, Krishna, Brahman or the absolute Krishna, for us, the ultimate Brahman, is Rasa. And rasa ultimately means the highest expression of love. So rasa vaisakha means basically God is love, what any other tradition will say. So if God is love, there is no chance for him not to love. He's made of love. So he's loving in every direction. That's how I will personally play out those statements.
But that even that statement, God is love, I mean, we couldn't really go to a specific verse anywhere and, here's the statement that says God is love.
Rasa Vai Saha, I just said it.
Well, rasa is, it's, yeah, it implies love, but it's relationship, isn't it? It's
But love is relationship.
a specific, it's a specific.
What about back to Basala?
But that could be more limited to his devotees.
Yeah.
There are many verses about how affectionate Krishna is to his
Yeah,
devotees,
yeah.
but then probably I'm saying maybe your question is, what about those who are not devotees?
Yeah.
No?
I mean,
Because
I'm
sometimes
not
again.
disputing the point. I do agree with that Krishna is love, but again, it's just, in a relationship, say between a man and a woman, or they're getting together at some point, so there's a declaration like, "I love you," and then the person feels it, and it's like, "Wow, someone loves me," or like a child. A parent to their child, "Oh, I love you, my sweet." Some parents don't say that. They don't know that they're loved, but there's a declaration. So, to me, it's a curiosity. It's very specific words that mean love, as opposed to things that infer love, like what you're quoting. I'm curious why Krishna himself never makes such a statement.
I will say that he makes it. I mean, I don't want to. I have many quotes. Actually, my next book will be about that. My fourth book will be about unconditional love. So it's basically not only a compilation of statements, but also when one says a compilation of statements, will that be? Let me say one thing. Will that be? I mean, I don't have all the statements at hand with me. But will that be equally enough if I share well from Srila Prabhupada in that regard?
Again, but they're like statements from sadhus who are expressing what Krishna, that Krishna does love us all, and that's nice, and it's reassuring to hear that. But again, a direct statement from Krishna himself, to me, like,
Mean, for me to hear, for him to say, Sauhridam Sarvabhutanam, that's it. I mean, I'm the best well-wishing friend of every living entity. Maybe we are thinking, okay, but he should have said, I love you. But those are our conditions, right? He says it in so many ways. And not only he says that, but he demonstrates that, which for me is that's the most important thing. No, because sometimes people say it
yes, love
and
isn't words, it's an expression of emotion and feeling and
Exchange. And also we have this idea, that's another degree of conversation, but related to what you say, there are certain sections of scripture Krishna himself says that he feels eternally indebted to his devotees. Let's go to his devotees for a moment, those who love him, and he never feels that he's loving them back enough. So he doesn't ever dare to say, I love you fully. He always feels indebted because that's the nature of love. So there's a saying in one book, Premasambhu, Buddha thing from Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, where it says, those who say, I love you, know nothing about love. Because when you start to love, you feel there's always so much more to love. So you don't feel I can say it as a final word. I love you, because you can always love more, which what we're talking today. Like Mahaprabhu. Mahaprabhu will say, Na prema gandosti darapi harome. Mahaprabhu is, if there's someone who experienced divine love, that's Sri Chaitanya. And he will say, in me, there is not even the aroma of divine love. So that's paradoxical, because he's fully experiencing that, but he's fully denying he has love. He has the most love, but the nature of love, if it creates this experience that I can have so much more, that whatever I have feels nothing comparison to that. So one could make an argument to say that maybe, okay, Krishna is not fully asserting that conclusively, because there's always so much more love to give, that to say I love you kind of like it's a close, how to say, it's a limiting statement. Is that a confirmation or disagreement with that?
Hit the button.
I have here one small quote from Prabhupada. And again, I don't want to sound like we're doing a quote battle here. But there are many. God loves us, Prabhupada say. Why not? We are his sons. Why he will not love us? God loves us more than we love him. We do not love him, but he loves. God loves every living being. Maybe you will have liked that to be said by Krishna, exactly like that in the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
But sometimes what Krishna is not saying is say through his pure devotee. You know? And remember, Krishna says, Sadhunam Hridayam Tvaham. I'm in the heart of my sadhus. So how much we can make a difference between what Krishna is saying and what someone like Prabhupada is saying. You know? So that's also part of the... We only learn through about Krishna's love through Krishna's lovers. So if they are telling us that, that's another way of putting it. But let me go to one more quote. A series of verses. This is a beautiful one. I always like to share. And it goes beyond the question. I think it's a beautiful meditation. And I go to what here, which is this happens, this is being said by Krishna through the pen of Sanatan Goswami in his Brihad Bhagavatamrita. But again, and one could say, oh no, that's Sanatan Goswami, that's not Krishna. No, no, that's Krishna through Sanatan Goswami. As we could say, Krishna, the Bhagavad Gita is Krishna through Vyasadev, who is compiling the Bhagavad Gita, and through Sanjaya, who is witnessing what's going on in trance. There's always some seer through which the message is revealed. So here are the words of Krishna to Gopa Kumar when he arrives to Golok Vrindavan. And again, take them not only limited to Gopa Kumar, but to every living being. Because Gopa Kumar, as we will see, in the beginning, he was not someone practicing bhakti, at least at one point in one lifetime. And Krishna will refer to that. So he's talking about how much he was loving and longing for him. So Gopa Kumar eventually becomes, of course, is born in Govardhan, becomes a Vaishnav, and attains Golok Vrindavan, as the Brihad Bhagavatamrita describes. So Krishna welcomes Gopa Kumar and says, welcome, welcome, my dear child. I am fortunate, most fortunate, to meet you here. This is not Gopa Kumar telling that to Krishna, the other way around, don't forget. For so long, I have been longing to see you. My dear friend and darling, you have passed through many lifetimes without so much as a glance in my direction. Yet, yes, yet, I was always there, a fool dancing with hope, thinking, perhaps in this lifetime, or this one, or this, he will finally turn to me. That's Krishna talking to Gopa Kumar. Yet, I could find no excuse to bring you to my abode, my brother, while still upholding the eternal laws I myself have created. You never called my name, not even once in passing. Had you done so, I could have bent the rules and brought you to me. But without your slightest intention, how could I? That would not have been love. It would have been a flawed wrongdoing. Realizing my own lack of mercy, Krishna is talking, I became restless. anxious as to how I could obtain your mercy and bring you to me, I transgress my eternal code of conduct and arrange for you to take birth in the sacred land of Govardhan, my most beloved abode. And I, my dear child, became your guru, known by the name Jayanta. Last verse, Krishna tells Gopakumar, today you have fulfilled the longing I have held in my heart for so long. Please nourish your happiness and mine by staying here forever. So that's how Krishna feels for each one of us. And that's what he's telling here to Gopakumar. For many lifetimes, you were not even calling my name by passing, but I was longing for you. That for me is Krishna telling us, I love you. I long for you. But again, love is voluntary. So he cannot just jump on us and cancel our free will and drag us by force to Golokrinda. Anyhow, some thoughts. But I appreciate your sharing. Thank you so much. It's brought a lot. Sorry for sharing so many quotes.
But no, they're beautiful. Thank you.
No, thank you. You were going to share something.
Yeah, I just remembered that sometimes you also talk about how Krishna likes indirect speech. So he wouldn't like directly say, I love you, but, you know, like in indirect ways, imply that. Like, so all these quotes you're saying, even though it's not directly saying, I love you, it is implied.
Yeah, Krishna says in the Bhagavatam, Paroksham Mama Chapriyam, I like when things are being done, said indirectly. Yeah, so, and especially love includes lots of indirect speech, no? When, between the loved and the beloved, where things are not said, like, obviously, that everyone understands that only those two are getting what's being said there, right? And yeah, of course, and we see even with to his devotees, when Krishna is in front of the highest, his highest devotees, so to say, highest the gopis, I want to say, so the highest, like, creating a superficial hierarchy, but we know. We know the love of the gopis, particularly Sri Radha. And Krishna saying, Napada yaham nirabhadya sanjayam, so sadhu krityam vibhudayu sappi bhanama bhajan lujjaragiha shrinkala sambrishchitatva pratiyatu sarana. He says, I've witnessed the degree of your love for me, and I cannot repay that love back. I cannot. It's too much. You love me too much. I cannot reciprocate accordingly. I've said that in the Bhagavad Gita, right? 4.11. According to your degree of surrender, I reciprocate. But now I'm witnessing the love you have for me. I have to contradict myself, so to say. You love me too much. I cannot reciprocate. Let your own love be your own reward. So Krishna, at that point, he cannot say, he's not saying to the gopis, I love you. He's more like, you love me so much. I don't know what to do with so much love. How to reciprocate? Of course, he loves them, but again, love in itself creates this humbling experience that it's so much the love received and so much the prospect of giving love that I may not dare to affirm, I'm doing that. I love you. That's why Sanatana Goswami says, Dhanya and Prem, humility and love are cause and effect of one another. The more love you have, the more humble you become. The more humble you become, the more love you have, and so on and so forth for eternity. So the greatest lovers, we may not be saying, I love you, because of what I explained so far, and also because I love you creates a separate sense of I and you. And in love, there is a communion, not an impersonal merging, but you and I became we. It's another dynamic union in love. So, anyhow, some thoughts, a beautiful topic to explore always. There's no final word in love. That's an important thing. I'm going there in a moment, Tim. I quote in my recent book where I try to give a definition of love, because we're using the word love a lot. But what's love? No, if someone asks for a definition, it's also, that's tricky, right? Because you give a definition and it kind of traps the experience of love in a formula, so to say. And I quote Rumi, the famous Sufi poet, and he says, we can never say enough about love. And he will say, when I pick my pen and I try to write the word love, what is big defining? Just write the word love, the pen broke. It's too much. Like implying, even if you write in the word, it's not even possible to write it. What if we're trying to define it and enclose love to one definition? So we may be trying our best forever and still feel there's so much more that can be said. So that's a healthy dissatisfaction, I will say. Oh, I've said this about love, but still this more can be said and still this. Tim, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I look at my main motivations, I think like I don't want to suffer, but I do like to enjoy. So it's not a very it's very it's what does Christian think of that? It's not very it's no like interest in developing pure love of God. It's just like I remember I was sick about 2 years ago with a stomach ache from overeating. And I was just like, and I'm just kind of like I was awake till 5 in the morning doing this, and I had a prep at Japa on a bit. But
Okay.
if I'm trying to think of Krishna a bit, it's more just I don't want to suffer. So it's not very, it's very far away from developing the pure love of God.
So what to do? What Krishna thinks of that was your question, right?
Very
So
interesting.
Krishna will, what Krishna replies to that is, he will say, "Dear Tim, we all have to begin somewhere. Welcome." I mean, I'm not giving my own answer. He says that in the Gita and in the Bhagavatam. No? In the Gita, he says, "Artha jignasu artha jnani tarvar." Different people come to me, and among those, he mentions four. Of course, not only four, but just a general way of classifying. Yeah. And the main one I will say is those who are suffering, and those who want relief from forms of suffering. Generally, those are the main ones who approach God in any tradition. So Krishna acknowledged that those who want money, those who want knowledge, and those who want me, Krishna says also. But Krishna is not saying, and I only accept those who want only me, or those who are the highest. All the other ones who want relief from suffering and money and knowledge, I reject them all. He's not saying that. He's speaking of the four. Of course, there may be a hierarchy of quality of approach, but Krishna is welcoming all of them. So Krishna is, again, it's loving and understanding and compassion. I'm not saying that to tell you, so you can stay there forever. That's totally fine. No. But also it's healthy, I think, to feel, oh, despite acknowledging that I'm not here for the highest purpose yet, still I'm already welcome. I already belong. I'm already part. Krishna already receives me. That gives us the inspiration to try to give back for deeper reasons, gradually. The Bhagavatam, there is this other verse which makes it even more clear. Say, Akamo Sarva Kamo Bha Moksha Kamo Dadaditi Brena Bhakti Yogena Jayeta Purusham Param. Bhagavan is saying, Akama Sarva Kama Moksha Kama. Kama means desire. So whether you are Akama, you have zero desires. Whether you are Sarva Kama, you have all the desires in the world, basically. Whether you are moksha kama, you only have one desire, liberation. I want to get rid of all desires. That's one desire. So whether you happen to be in these three groups or in the spectrum in between these three, you have no desires, you have only one desire, mukti, or you have all the desires, tibrena bhakti yogena jayeta purusham. Just engage in bhakti. Again, it's not that first become pure, perfect, immaculate, and then we practice bhakti. It will never happen. No. First become renounced, detached from whatever, and then become a devotee. No, first practice bhakti, and the other things will follow as a result of that. Janayati asubairagyam jainam chayada haitukam. By practicing bhakti, detachment of all that we need to be detached from follows. No. So those are verses that are very hopeful for all of us. And I would say, just if it helps, Tim, that you are not alone in that, right? Because sometimes when we isolate ourselves, like I acknowledge that I have something to confess. I am not practicing for this reason, but oh, welcome to the club. No? Somehow or other, most all of us on some level or not may still be driven by some of this. And that's part of the journey again. And I will say the fact that you had the courage to publicly acknowledge that in itself, that's a lot. Because many of us may have all those secret agendas, but we do not dare to expose them. So we keep them in secrecy. And of course, when we keep them in secrecy, they become even more influential. So exposing them really weakens their strength, and we can gradually participate in this journey for deeper and deeper reasons. And it's an ongoing journey of deeper and deeper, so it never ends also. So, so I hope that helps. Again, just to go back to my initial answer, we all have to begin somewhere. And from there, we continue. Something else before putting our sharing to rest. Yeah.
In regard to that, when I was a young man, I suffered really badly, a very difficult childhood, and even tried suicide. And I got the Bhagavad Gita. So I was really suffering. But I see now that that was a blessing because I wouldn't have sought. And I'm still seeking, of course, proper love for God. And now my body's getting older, but I still have deep down that type of suffering. It's now and again comes up more. And then I have to go more toward, oh, Krishna, why are you Krishna? What is love? So that's kind of fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing. And of course, that's a whole conversation that deserves to be had, which is suffering and pain and what to do with that, because sometimes we just go to Krishna like, get me free of this suffering. At one point we learned, at least I speak for me, is at the end of this, not so much stop suffering, but learning to suffer. Because there's suffering is always there in one way or another, even when you become a pure devotee. Sorry to say that, guys. There is suffering in the spiritual world. When Krishna and Radharani are separated from each other, one example, they are really suffering. They are not making a show. I'm dying in separation of you. They are dying in separation from each other. They never die, but they feel like they die. Of course, it's a different suffering. That's an important clarification. It's not the same suffering we may be experiencing in a conditioned state, but still, there is a form of suffering. So we have to be very careful not to reject suffering altogether, because then we will realize, oh, there is still suffering in eternity in the context of love, which is not bad at all. I will say it's a heart-expanding suffering. Like now, compassion is that. Compassion means, the very word compassion means to suffer with, compassion. And that's a very glorified quality in a devotee, compassion, which implies the devotee suffers. Krishna says in the Gita, right? The symptom of a proper devotee is he or she makes other people's suffering their own. They are so empathic that if I see you suffering, I will connect so much with that that it becomes my pain. But that's Krishna's praising that. I totally understand that in one point of our journey, we are, and I was there also, just in case. I'm suffering. I want to stop this. But then we realize there are other ways to deal with suffering that we don't need to like push that away. But suffering is also a guru, right? There's so much to learn from pain.
It's
Pain
a
opens our heart so
kind
much.
of a blessing in a
Yeah,
sense.
opens our heart so much. At least I can think in the most painful moments of my life. Probably were the moments where I was the most present in the here and now. No, my mind was not going like, oh, future, past, was here. So that makes life all the more real and deep. So just mentioning that briefly, just to clarify in connection to what you mentioned, that there's a place for suffering in love. So we have to be very careful not to totally dismiss all faults forms of suffering, because there's so many emotions that happen in love. Even Rupa Goswami will describe this different rasas in eternity. And apart from Of course, Samta Dasi Sakya Vatsalya Madhurya, that he described the secondary rasas, and many of them are related to emotions that we may label as undesirable, no? Like disgust, Bibhatsa rasa, anger, Rodra rasa, Bhayanaka rasa, fear. So we may think, oh, all those things do not exist in the spiritual world. Yeah, they do. But in the context of love, which makes the whole experience qualitatively different from anything we may have experienced so far. So we have to be careful not to project. And since it can happen so easily, for some time we may need not to go there. Right? And maybe in the beginning of our journey, it may be too much to think about fear in the spiritual world. We may need to work on our fear here because it's a full circle that maybe. Something that takes time to understand, but
I'm sure there's a difference between the suffering of the soul and the suffering of the mind as well. Because suffering of the mind could be, I don't want to chant.
I
The
don't
soul,
want
I don't want to chant, but the soul might want to chant. So it could conflict or.
and that's why we are trying to make, as you say, thanks for
Excellent.
coming.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks for
Thanks
having me.
so much. Yeah, that's why it's so important to make this difference. In both cases, we use the same word. But the experience is very different. It's coming from a very different source, so to say. Okay. I think we can put this sharing to rest so we do not overextend. If one has other things to do, we'll be sharing some prasad, some more informal sharing. And those who have time, tomorrow we have one more meeting at the house of Shwetati Bradic and Amanda Bikram. Feel free, more than invited. And if not, it's been a pleasure to. With you all, thank you for receiving us here with your presence, your questions, your attention. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Gaur, Vancha Kalpataru Vishaya, Pasindu Kirevachab, Titanam Pavanepyo Vaishnavepyo Namo.